brought to you by the Small Business Payments Alliance. According to a new survey, an overwhelming majority of small business owners oppose additional government regulations on the electronic payment system, as called for in the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. Don't let Durbin-Marshall pile new mandates on Main Street small businesses. Learn more at smallbusinesspaymentsalliance.com.
Nerdcast is brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. Engaging video lectures presented by top university professors on a variety of topics. It's the perfect way to learn for the pure pleasure of it. With The Great Courses Plus, you'll have unlimited access to a wealth of knowledge. Watch lectures from any device on your own schedule. Sign up today and get your first month free. Go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdcast.
It's Thursday, August 18th, and I'm Kristen Roberts, National Editor. Here are the numbers that mattered this week. 81. That's the number of days Trump's new team has to turn this campaign around and manufacture the win. 2. The number of rallies Clinton had this week. 11. That's Trump's lead in the only bright spot shining on his map, Indiana. And another number, too. That's the number of states where Evan McMullen has successfully gotten his name added to the ballot. We'll talk to McMullen by Skype at the top of the show. Grab your calculators and enjoy the 2016 Nerdcast. Hello, party people. Scott Bland.
Hello.
Hadass Gold.
Hello.
And a very special welcome to Politico's Clinton campaign reporter, Annie Carney.
Hello.
Woo!
Annie gets to fill in for Charlie and Eli and Ken.
Woohoo.
We only have one boy in the room today. Plus, well, I guess we have two boys in the room. We have our producer, too. All right. Let's get started. So we're going to do something different on our podcast today. We are speaking with one of the third party candidates for president. It's Mr. Evan McMullen, who has launched an independent bid. Thank you for joining us, Evan.
Thank you.
Scott, shoot.
Evan, why don't you just start out, tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, I feel like we're so used to hearing from people running for president about how every moment of their life has prepared them for this, you know, crucible that they've dived into. And you just jumped in a couple weeks ago. So, you know, tell us a little bit about how you got here.
Well, I'll try to spare you the whole entire life story. But I was born in Utah, raised in the Seattle area. Went to school at Brigham Young University for undergrad. While I was there, I started working for the Central Intelligence Agency. So I would do a semester on and a semester off, going back and forth between Utah and Washington, D.C. Then when I graduated, I went undercover with the CIA, went through training. While I was in that process, 9/11 happened. And so when I finished, I went overseas. I volunteered to go overseas and serve in the war zones, the post 9/11 war zones. And so I did a range of counterterrorism operations and traditional clandestine intelligence operations. Then after I completed my service at the CIA, I went to Wharton for business school and then spent a couple of years at Goldman Sachs in the investment banking division in San Francisco. And then had the opportunity to come back to Washington and serve again as a national security advisor to the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And then from there, went up to the House Republican Conference and served as the chief policy director there for the better part of a couple of years until I decided to launch this presidential campaign last week. That's it in a nutshell.
So when you were at work in the House and looking at what was happening during the GOP primary process, at what point did you realize Donald Trump was going to be the nominee, or did you not know until the moment Ted Cruz dropped out?
Well, I think I had hope the whole way through that Donald Trump would not actually be the nominee. Of course, as the field remained so populated by so many candidates and Donald Trump was able to galvanize a certain minority segment of the Republican voting base, concern grew. There's no doubt about that. But I had hope until the very end, even until the convention, candidly, that somehow, some way, he would not actually be the nominee, that somehow he would be stopped in a way that was still consistent with process rules and all of that. But it did happen. And a lot of other people were concerned. I was concerned. There were various different phases that people in Congress, staff and members went through, starting from, you know, early on, Donald Trump is a complete joke. There's no way he'll win, to, well, he's gaining steam, but still he won't win, to, my goodness, he could win. And then finally, he's going to win the nomination. And it was interesting and disheartening to see that develop the way it did. But yeah, I had a front row seat there.
Forgive me for being so frank, but there are very few people on earth who think you can win the presidency. Do you think you can win the presidency?
Yeah, we think we can. I mean, obviously, it's a hard road ahead. But this isn't, we didn't choose the timing of this, nor did I think I was I wasn't the one who I wanted to see out there doing this. I had hoped somebody with national name ID who perhaps had run before would step forward, or even somebody who hadn't run before but who had national name ID would step in and do this. And I hoped for this and advocated for it and talked to people about it, encouraged some to do it. About 3 weeks ago, or a little more than that now, I checked in realizing that it was the last possible moment when anyone could have a chance to defeat Donald Trump and provide a better option all around between, you know, other than Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, to the American people. And so I reached out to people who I knew were working on the project, and the response I got was that they still did not have anybody. There had been some optimism at different points that there would be, and so I decided then that I needed to jump in after the idea was proposed to me.
So let me back up a little bit into your bio. I mean, it didn't sound like there was any room in there for this, but have you ever been a candidate for anything before? City council, student council, you know, going all the way back? Have you ever run for something?
It's nothing that I can leverage in this case. I was the student body president in my elementary school. So
awesome.
Yeah, I had a great slogan. It was a man with a plan, and it was great. But no, listen.
You should bring that back. You should bring that back.
Maybe I should. I'll run it past the team. We'll see what my comms people think about that. But look, this is the thing. You know, I think we need to get away in this country from this idea that you need to be a career politician or even have been a politician before to hold key leadership positions, even the presidency. I do think it's important to understand how the government works, which I certainly do, and understand what kind of, in this environment, reforms need to happen so that the American people feel like they're being heard again. Then I understand that too. My experiences have given me that as well. So I feel that I'm prepared, and I'm glad that I bring some things to the table that I would not be able to bring to the table had I been in politics my entire life.
Walk us through a bit the decision-making process on this. You know, who did you consult on the Hill? Who did you consult in the House as you were considering whether this was the move you were going to make?
I don't want to say names of everyone I consulted, but I will say that I consulted members of Congress. I consulted very close friends. I consulted members of the media, candidly. I consulted potential donors and my family. And those were the groups of people that I was talking to. Yeah.
And where in the country do you see your greatest base of support?
Well, I think it's early for me to say that. I think obviously there's a great opportunity in the Mountain West, where there's been the opposition to Donald Trump and to Hillary Clinton has been strongest. So Utah, certainly, Colorado, I think, Idaho as well, elsewhere in the Mountain West. But also there are other places across the country and people just around the country who are rejecting Donald Trump's message of bigotry and misogyny and divisiveness, as well as Hillary Clinton's, what I think are old ideas about a large centralized government where insiders thrive. They're rejecting this. They want something new. 82% of the American people feel the country's on the wrong track, and it's increased by about 13% since June, which I attribute mostly to the way the presidential election has gone and to how people look at their two major party options. So people are really hungry across the country for a better choice, and we hope to offer that to them.
To be able to take advantage of any of that hunger, you actually have to be on the ballot in these states, right? Can you talk to us a little bit about the process of doing that? Because in a lot of places, there are very high bars. And we've talked about this a little bit before, but the especially for third-party candidates, right? There are enormous numbers of petition signatures that you have to gather and other hurdles that you have to clear that in some cases have been designed almost expressly to prevent what you're trying to do.
Yeah. Well, you're very right about that, and you know, some of these states have requirements, enormous signature requirements that are really unrealistic and wholly designed to keep out independent voices, which is troubling because 42% of Americans consider themselves independent, and only 28% consider themselves Democrats, and only 28% consider themselves Republicans. So, you know, this isn't right. And I think this has that figure, that 42%, I think has a lot to do with the 82% I talked about earlier, 82% of Americans feeling like we're on the wrong track. So yes, some states have these rules that are designed to keep us off the ballot. I will say one thing, though, that although we want to be on the ballot in all 50 states and we're going to be pursuing a strategy to get on as many as possible.
And that includes legal action.
That includes legal action, and I'll get to that in a second. But I just want to make clear that in almost all cases, a write-in campaign is also an option. And there have been times when write-in campaigns have been successful. And yes, they require some voter education and messaging and all of that around what exactly is required. But that's also a possibility in almost every case. In terms of getting on the ballot, we'll be doing petitions where that's possible. We're working with third parties who want to share their ballot lines with us. More and more of them are approaching us saying, hey, we want to be part of this. We support what you're doing. So that's helpful too. And then we are preparing legal challenges in states that especially have particularly onerous requirements to get onto the ballot.
How much money will you need to win?
Well, I will just say that we've been, that's another thing we've been surprised by just the amount of people who are donating in small numbers, but it adds up. We will have, I believe, plenty of resources to do what we need to do. We certainly have now more than we need for our needs, and we're going to be able to mount a national campaign.
So, but you don't want to give us an estimate of the total figure you will need raise?
No, I don't, because obviously that's extremely sensitive, competitive information for us. And
okay, sure, but help me understand. You know, when we look at the quarterly, when we look at the monthly filings, you know, what would represent a good month for the McMullen campaign?
Well, again, I'm not going to share numbers. You'll see those numbers when they come out. But we're confident based on the response we've seen in just 1 week, when our name ID is just at its nascent stages, that we are going to have what we need to mount a campaign. Obviously, I mean, I will say that internally we have numbers that are sort of like, look, we can mount a credible campaign with this range of money, this range of funding. We can do this much more with this much. I mean, we have all of that. But what I will say is that we are on track right now, even in this first week when people are just learning about who I am, to have what we need to mount a very credible national campaign along our strategy. So we feel good about that. You know, we're not going to be we may not be sort of you know, raising the kind of money in 2.5 to 3 months that a campaign like Jeb Bush was able to raise even before launching. But that's not the kind of campaign we're running. This campaign is highly unusual and unorthodox, but we're able to be, we believe, successful given our strategy, even under those realities.
You mentioned Utah a minute ago, and I want to return to that really quickly, just because if your run isn't successful, if you're not elected president in November, have you thought at all about other ways in which you might try and pursue these goals you're talking about? You know, in Utah, there's a Senate race up in 2018. There's, you know, four House seats that all lean pretty heavily Republican, and you know there's always a chance of turnover there. Have you given any thought to potentially running for office there in the future after kind of building up your name a little bit during this campaign?
Yeah, I've gotten that question a few times, and no, I'm not thinking about it now. I made this decision to run for president very quickly, within 10 days. I'm very focused on the task at hand here. I believe Donald Trump presents a true threat to this country, and that the people deserve a better option than Hillary Clinton, who I believe is a corrupt politician who cannot be trusted. This is what I'm focused on. Yes, I feel very passionately about these issues. I imagine in some capacity, you know, if I'm elected, obviously, as president, and I do see a path to victory, a couple of paths to victory, by the way, I want to make that clear. And we're pursuing those. But if I'm not elected, then I imagine that I'll stay engaged in some level. But in on what level and in what way, I'm not sure. But I'm not really thinking about it now. There's very serious work to be done right now. And it's urgent. And I'm focused on that. And I invite all people who hear this to go to evanmcmullen.com and sign up and get involved and support us, because We need to continue to have the support of the American people to drive this forward, to provide them a better option in this election.
That's terrific, Evan. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I hope to be back.
This political season, you've heard all the speeches, you've seen the news. Now we want you to learn the history behind it all, and here's the way. Sign up for The Great Courses Plus. You'll get unlimited access to engaging video lectures on history, politics, economics, and so many more subjects that will explain how we got to this moment, presented by award-winning professors and experts. Sign up for The Great Courses Plus now, and you'll get a free month of unlimited access to all of the courses, including The Skeptic's Guide to American History. Start your free month now by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdcast. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdcast.
All right, back to the normal run of show here. Our first data point is 81. That's the number of days Trump's new team has to turn this campaign around and manufacture the win. So what have we seen this week, Scott? We've seen a new campaign manager. We've seen a new campaign CEO. What does it all mean?
It means, as one of our colleagues wrote this morning, that they're looking toward letting Trump be Trump for the remainder of this election. You know, the new CEO is Steve Bannon, the kind of driving force behind Breitbart News. The new campaign manager is Kellyanne Conway, a pollster who's been with him for a while, was previously running one of the pro-Cruz super PACs, kind of that umbrella effort that brought in a lot of outside groups. And it seems very much like a kind of retrenchment move. You know, there's been a lot of news over the past few weeks about Paul Manafort, who campaign chairman, right? We've got mm-hmm. now we've got a CEO, a chairman, and a manager. But the campaign chairman, you know, trying to kind of push Trump to act more like a normal presidential candidate. And this is, you know, seems like a few giant steps in the opposite direction.
Hadass, tell me about Bannon.
I feel like we're living in, to quote Stranger Things, the upside down right now, because everybody always joked about how like Breitbart and Trump were kind of the same, how Breitbart was like Trump's Pravda. And now it's actually happening in real life. Mm-hmm. And so Steve Bannon he's now taking leave of absence, the CEO of Breitbart, which is this, you know, very right wing populist website that, you know, no holds barred. He took over actually after Andrew Breitbart, who is the founder of Breitbart, died. And he is a hard charging chief of Breitbart. And if you like, he has a heavy hand in a lot of how Breitbart acts and what it does. He also is a host of a radio show. And he's a really fascinating guy because he was in the Navy. He is a Wall Street banker. And he also is rich partly because of his investment in Seinfeld, in managing the deal to like syndicate Seinfeld. So every time you watch Seinfeld, he's getting money from it.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. So he's very independently wealthy. He's not being paid by the Trump campaign. He's doing this for free. And it's full circle. You know, Breitbart for the last year has been unabashedly pro-Trump. And it's funny because they were initially pro-Cruz. You know, they did like this night before thing with Cruz and his family and Cruz reading bedtime stories to his little girls. This is the next president of the United States, etc.
This is right before he launched his campaign.
Right before Cruz launched his campaign, they spent the night before with him and took photos, and it was lovely. And what's funny is actually I had been told that Kellyanne Conway, who used to be working for a pro-Cruz super PAC, had complained to Bannon about their anti-Cruz coverage over time, how it had changed over time. And now the two are working together. She had reportedly told people that she would turn open Breitbart and thought she was reading The Onion because it was so crazy anti-Cruz. And, you know, it just goes to show you that politics is politics. And now these two are working together.
Well, this is more than just typical politics, right? I mean, the kind of things that we can expect from this campaign now that we've got a guy like Bannon as CEO, whatever that's going to mean, on the Trump campaign means a turn to what some people have already termed the political dark arts. I mean, what kind of final stretch here should we expect?
You should expect every, you know, dirty thing in the book to be thrown at Clinton, and no pretenses of, you know, basic courtesy will be exhibited here. I would fully expect every previous scandal to be brought up. I would expect things from, like,
not just scandals though, conspiracy theories as well.
Conspiracy theories about her health. Like, why is Donald Trump talking about Hillary Clinton's health right now? Well, you know, the Drudge Report and Sean Hannity are all bringing this up, and Breitbart has covered this as well. You're going to see, like, they have headlines like Huma Abedin relied on her Muslim faith to get her through tough times. You know, those are the nuggets that they pull out. And so they're going to bring up Huma. They're going to bring just like every possible conspiracy that has previously kind of been kept along the edges of, you know, of attacks, never really brought to the forefront because they were kind of outlandish, are now going to just be fully out there. And also the relationship with the media is not, it's going to potentially get worse, you know,
impossible.
If you thought it was bad now, just imagine, you know, with Bannon, you know, just look at any of the covers that they've had. They called Bill Kristol a renegade Jew for a column he wrote. And, you know, this is any pretense of what Mike Pence said about how they were looking at reevaluating the blacklist or anything like that. I mean, I expect more personal attacks on reporters, more personal attacks on opponents.
All right, let's not make it about us. Annie, is the Clinton campaign ready for this? And don't tell me yes.
So here's their strategy. They had a conference call yesterday with their campaign manager, Robbie Mook, to talk about Bannon, which I found really unusual because they didn't have a conference call to talk about Corey Lewandowski when he got fired.
That's
or
right.
Paul Manafort. They've been pretty much focused on Trump and not trying to get distracted by the side stories and talking about how he's unfit for office. But this, they suddenly had a conference call that was all about Bannon, about how he supports white supremacists, all the things Hadass just talked about. He anti-Semitism, anti-Muslim rhetoric is what he sells. And the reason they did this is they want, like, so the next time Trump comes out with some crazy attack on Hillary, they want the coverage to be like, this is the hand of Bannon at work. Mm-hmm. This is this dark arts conspiracy theorist. Like,
they're trying to make the Trump campaign look like it's an ultra extremist operation.
Right. So they want us all to, like, in our coverage, when we write about Trump's attacks, like, write about Bannon and everything that he has to show for himself, so that Trump becomes a fringe extremist character.
Yeah, I think just the thing I would add to that is it's for as long as Trump has been running for president, it seems like his as much as he talked about polls last year, he was a like ratings driven candidate. You know, it's like everything and this like fusion between his campaign and this new media operation, I think is really interesting, right? That has generated so many clicks and so much attention off of Trump and the movement that is built up behind him. Whether it's going to help his campaign in any way seems like a really dodgy kind of thing to expect, right? You know, like for the first time in Trump's career, it's not just the ratings that matter. It like matters for the first time that people are hate watching him now. And you can see that in his unfavorability numbers being so high and actually kind of starting to like tick up a little bit more.
Yeah. And one thing that Democrats think, I talked to Dan Pfeiffer for a story I wrote yesterday, who said he sees this as a play for Trump. Like, Trump's not assuming he's going to win anymore. And how is he going to monetize this after the election? And the best way to monetize it is to double down on the authentic and that base that really loves him, that got him to be the nominee, will continue to support him. and that this could be like a play for Trump TV or whatever comes next.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. I mean, think about the people he has surrounded himself with right now. And there's been reporting that Jared Kushner, who already owns a newspaper, has been talking to Donald Trump potentially about investing in some kind of media company or taking it over full bore. Now you have Roger Ailes working with him. You have Steve Bannon working for him. And you have Jared Kushner, who owns a newspaper. You have all of this media, all of these media people surrounding him. Trump's obsessed with the media. He's had his own show. He's already made attempts at, you know, having magazines and things like that. I could totally see after the election, Trump either trying to take over, making a new news network, or at least, at the very least, probably like taking over a website or Breitbart.
I cannot buy into the idea that Donald Trump is no longer in this to win it.
No, I think I agree. He still wants,
I'm just
to
saying,
be the
contingency
president.
Plan. If he doesn't win,
no. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying about what he might do after he loses. If he loses, what I'm saying is, you know, Pfeiffer might be out there saying he's given up, and this is his play to set the stage or lay the groundwork.
I think it can be both.
It can be.
It's
both.
It's not that he's given up.
No. It can't be both. I'm disagreeing with you. he's not giving up on the presidency.
No, but he's also setting himself up so that, you know, he's going to win. It's better to win on his. Lose on his own terms than lose as like someone who is straitjacketed.
All right, next data point, the number 2. That's the number of rallies Hillary Clinton had this week. Hillary Clinton's people are feeling really good, Annie. Are they feeling too good?
Yeah, they're feeling happy. I think they just don't see a path for Donald Trump, and there's 81 days left, and the time and the desire of him to change seems minimal. I think so. This is what someone I was talking to on the campaign told me, that I think they all feel good. She doesn't like to hear, it would be really frowned upon to say something like, "You're the next president," to Hillary Clinton or near her. Like, she doesn't want to hear that right now.
Is it because she's appropriately cautious and aware
I think
of
she
the
is
uncertainty
cautious.
Of the final 80 days?
I think she's really cautious, and like, how is it helpful to, they don't want to be like sitting back and not taking it seriously. It's still like.
Well, I mean, let's look at this calendar. We've got 5 big days left in the calendar. One is Election Day, obviously, but we have 4 debates, and maybe mm-hmm. the biggest day of the last stretch of this campaign besides Election Day is going to be at the end of September when we have the first presidential debate.
Isn't she also better when she thinks she's behind? Yes, like, she's always a better candidate, she's a better debater when she thinks that she's not winning. And I feel like if she's going to go into these debates, like, all, like, full
of herself.
Yeah, they
have a lot of work to do. Like, the first debate is going to be brutal. And like we were just talking about, he's going to throw everything at her. Preparing for that is going to be really hard. She could easily have one terrible debate of the 4 debates, right? She could, I mean, there'll be moments when we all write stories that like, oh no, maybe she's crashing and burning at some point if she messes up.
Well, let's talk
it.
About Monica Lewinsky for a second, yeah. Who has not been heard from for a while.
Yeah, who's she going to vote for?
Oh, man. That's not where I was going to go with this, but that's a good question.
Sorry.
Monica Lewinsky will come up at the debate for sure.
For sure.
Jennifer Flowers.
Yes.
And what's the right reaction for Hillary Clinton? What are her people, what's the coaching going
on
behind
I think,
the scenes
I mean,
here?
The coaching has to be, I mean, I wrote about this week, that it's the most awkward job in politics is to play Donald Trump in debate prep, because you have to out-Trump Trump. You have to be so mean to her and get her so rattled that when she gets on that debate stage, like, whatever he does seems tame by comparison. And who really wants to do that to the person who's most likely to be the next president of the United States right now? It's awkward. It's tense. But they have to bring up everything. They have to bring up conspiracy theories about Vince Foster. They have to talk about her health and whatever else, and her husband's infidelities. But I think in the end, I don't know, like, I was thinking about this. I think, do you want me to say what I think would be a good response?
You tell me if you want to tell people what you think.
I mean, I think that he's so far behind in the polls that I don't think she needs to engage with him that much. I think she needs to say, like, you're Donald, you're a small man with small ideas, and this is below what the American people need to talk
Scott.
About.
Honestly,
shift.
I think this gets back to the fact that this data point that we started the segment with, that she's only had a couple rallies this week. Like, why should she be having more rallies right now? I don't think it's overconfidence necessarily. I think it's a strategy that's working of mm-hmm. let, you know, first of all, you've got the Olympics out there kind of like sucking up like all kinds of media oxygen. And then Trump is filling up the rest of it with, you know, being on fire, frankly. So why bother being part of that conversation? You know, why take the risk of going out in public and saying anything that, you know, you every time you do something like that, you run the risk of potentially turning, you know, a negative story against yourself. So why, like, why bother?
Especially when you can just go on to your own podcast and talk to your own people about the things that you want to do. I do actually, though, question whether there is a level of overconfidence inside the campaign. I wonder about coming out as Robbie did yesterday with these comments about Bannon and what that says about the Trump campaign. And I wonder whether heading into September, knowing the big debate day that's on the horizon and knowing that there will be something massive that drops in October that hurts her, whether they are running the risk of feeling like they already have it in the bag.
I mean, I'm just picturing a debate where we count up all of the things that Donald Trump throws at her. I can already see our list, like the 15 worst 50 worst, you know, insults or worst, you know, painful moments Donald Trump brings up on stage. He could just sit there and like read a list, and just because at this point, that's what I feel like. You know, why not? Just like,
but Scott, what do we know about attacks against women on stage, right? And what do we know about what Donald Trump has done and the reaction of the public when he has gone down that path? I mean, we have a couple examples. We have Carly Fiorina. We have Megyn Kelly. What do we know?
Yeah, I mean, we know that those stories kind of, first of all, that was back in the time when I think we were still in a mode of saying, it's like, aha, this is the moment that's going to end Trump. And we've long since stopped kind of going back to that idea that never actually came to pass during the primaries. But I think those things were also, you know, they worked for him in the primary, but they also happened around the time that his unfavorables were continuing to climb to the place where they are now in the general, among the general electorate, which is a very bad place to be. And also, I think Hillary Clinton's own career has some examples of this. You know, there's that famous confrontation that she had in her 2000 Senate debate with Rick Lazio, who kind of crossed the stage and got in her face a little bit. And, you know, our colleague Glenn Thrush interviewed Clinton about this on his podcast earlier this year and kind of talked through that moment with her and how in that moment she said that she kind of recognized that he was overstepping. But some of her male advisors afterwards were very concerned that he had made her look weak in that moment. And it turned out to absolutely not be the case. And, I think the campaign professionals kind of focused on 50% plus one in Trump world will be very concerned about a potential moment like that. The question is whether those are the kind of people who are going to be in charge of making a decision about how aggressive he's going to be in these debates.
I wonder if her unfavorables are just so high that one big data dump on her that is damaging in October could really take the wind out of those sails.
Maybe. I think something that I don't know if we've talked about in the last few weeks, and we're really just kind of starting to see the trend now, is actually her unfavorables have gone down significantly. Her and Trump are not in the same place anymore in terms of their unfavorability. You know, I think in June or July before the conventions, she was around 55, 57, and he was around 60. And she has gone down and he's gone up since then in terms of the number of people who view the candidates unfavorably, and there's a pretty significant gap between them at this point. So I think she certainly remains susceptible to something like that, but Trump continues to get more unpopular while she's kind of muddling around a bit.
Let's talk about another number, and it's zero. And that's how much Donald Trump has spent on ads so far this cycle. That's about to change, isn't it, Scott?
Yeah, so he aired ads during the primary, but he's done nothing in the general election so far. And his campaign said earlier this week that they were going to start finally airing TV ads in a few select swing states. And we're starting to see, according to media buyers, we're starting to see actual money flow into and contracts flow into TV stations from the Trump campaign in some of the states you would imagine, Ohio, Florida, your kind of prototypical swing states. I think the question at this point is just how much do they decide to spend on this initial set of ads after not doing anything for the longest time, while, you know, Hillary Clinton was spending millions just during the Olympics, and Priorities USA has been kind of bashing Trump pretty hard in all the swing states for months now.
Well, there's a great deal of frustration inside the campaign about how they haven't spent a dime on this. I mean, you mentioned Hillary Clinton being out there with ads during the Olympics, and a moment when America is shown to be great already, right? And now we've got campaign insiders telling us he should have been on the air during the Olympics, and he has to be on air during football season. And the question really is, where is he going to be on air? What are those ads going to say? And how many are there going to be? Or is he going to go back and rely on the free media experience he had?
That's the thing. He hates paying for ads, and he has gotten billions of dollars in free media. So I'm sure that he's thinking, why should I spend this money when it's unnecessary? Although it seems as though he's being convinced, and the best way to convince him is through polls and through numbers. Kellyanne Conway's new campaign manager, who I should note, I think is the first female campaign manager for a Republican nominee. Is that true? I think so. Which seems to get lost in all of this, all the other news. You would think the campaign might want to highlight that a little bit more. But she's a pollster, and she is known for convincing pretty much Donald Trump through the language that he understands, which is ratings and numbers and polls and things like that. What's going to be really interesting is we're going to get, I think, the FEC deadline pretty soon. And that's going to tell us what he is spending his money on, which I'm sure will be really fascinating to see. If he's not spending money on the ads in the last couple months, where has that money gone?
Annie, why is Clinton pulling back on spending on ads in some places?
It's a calculation of the polls. I mean, she's up by 14 in Virginia. They pulled their ads from Colorado. Like, there's just, I think they think that there's no race there that they need to be spending their money on.
Yeah, and I just think, you know, the money that Clinton is pulling in and out of various markets is getting kind of reinvested everywhere. And we know that it's all being driven by the same type of analytics focus that the Obama campaign used to make its decisions to much renown after 2012. And I went and looked up the numbers on Open Secrets Day. You know, the Obama campaign, which is, you know, at this point considered like the gold standard for what a national campaign should be doing from a technical standpoint, not in terms of, you know, party or messaging or anything, but just in terms of the nuts and bolts of running a national campaign, they spent fully two-thirds of their money on media in 2012, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. And Trump has spent 40% of his campaign dollars on media at this point. And so, you know, I'm even though the TV ads are starting, I'm still wondering just how much of them there's going to be and how much they're going to kind of bump up that ratio, because as Hadass pointed out, you know, the free media isn't really doing it for him anymore. And I know he has not liked to do this stuff in the past, but it's kind of necessary.
All right. Next and last number of the show is 11. That's Trump's lead in the only bright spot shining on a very dark map for that campaign. And that's in Indiana, of all places. Scott, is it a Pence effect? What is happening in Indiana?
Yeah, I think Pence probably has something to do with it, though it's worth remembering that Pence was locked in a very, very tight, tough governor's race in Indiana before he dropped out to join Trump's ticket. But, you know, the other fact of the matter is Indiana, despite that brief 08 Obama interregnum, is a red state. It's kind of demographically set up as the type of place where Trump could do well, right? It's, you know, it's got a hefty share of blue collar white voters there. And you know, I think the Democratic brand in states like that has really taken a hit in the past few years. You know, Evan Bayh is now running for Senate again there and is really a blast from the past. And you know, he's running so much better than Clinton or even the Democratic gubernatorial nominee there in these polls, because, you know, solely on the basis of his name and his family name in state politics for decades now. And it's, you know, the game has just changed there for the Democratic Party.
I can just see some of our listeners writing into us and wondering really what we're basing some of this really profound negativity about Trump's chances on. And so I just want to go through some of these numbers, because all of our listeners will remember that both Charlie and I actually see a path for Donald Trump. Whether he can take advantage of that in September and turn this thing around is another question. But here's where the numbers stand right now. Okay, in each of the 11 states used in our own Battleground States project, both in our overall average and the most recent polls conducted in each state, the margins aren't even close. In Pennsylvania, he's down 11. In Virginia, he's down 12. In Florida, he's down 9, according to a poll from this week. These are not numbers from which a candidate has rebounded at this point in the cycle. And that's what speaks to, I'm looking across the table at Annie and at Hadass, like that's what speaks to all the other things we're seeing, the confidence in the Clinton campaign, the shock that's running through Republican quarters, but also, frankly, you know, the not surprising development that he's going back to people like Bannon and Roger Stone and going back to the type of advisors who helped launch him at the beginning of the primary season, no?
Yeah, I mean, he's pretty much hunkering down to what he knows and what he thinks is what was his success before. And he thinks that that's what's going to help him out.
But that was for some like 14 million Republican primary voters. Like that, like when I say that to the Clinton campaign's top advisors, they sort of laugh and say, why would he think that what works in the Republican primary has any bearing on a general election electorate? That's where their confidence comes
from.
Yeah,
I don't know the answer for exactly. I mean, it honestly sounds, what Trump did with his campaign shakeup just sounds like he, as he has said many times publicly, he thinks he's the best advisor to himself. He thinks he knows and he goes based off of his gut. And this is what he thinks is going to be the right way. And maybe if they get enough of that base somehow on his side. I mean, I can't imagine Steve Bannon advising a campaign that would in any way try to win over Hispanics or minorities or a lot of people like that.
I mean, it brings a sort of full circle, Scott, to Evan McMullen, who we spoke with at the top of the show. He's emerging as a guy with really not great chance of winning the presidency, but he's certainly speaking to a huge number of Republican voters who are looking at the current state of their nominee's campaign and saying, there's no way we win. What are the options?
Mm-hmm. I think McMullen, and he said this a few times, you know, he's really keyed in on this large number of voters who say that America is on the wrong track, the large number who say they have unfavorable opinions of Clinton and of Trump. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, Donald Trump has a chance, though slim, of winning the presidency at this point. You need to kind of shrink that by another factor of 10 or 100 to get to where Evan McMullen's chances are. There's just no precedent for third-party candidacies, especially ones who are, you know, kind of having to get on the ballot little by little, state by state, taking off in this kind of situation. And you know, again, we've talked a little bit about how, while two candidates this unpopular doesn't really have precedence at the national level, it has a lot of precedence at the state level, you know, especially where super PACs can really outspend a lot of Senate or especially House candidates. But you never really see a third party candidate jumping up as a result of that. You might see it in the polls for a little bit and then they fall back as you get closer to Election Day. People end up voting in these circumstances for the candidate who's maybe not most popular, but least unpopular.
Hadass, what do you see coming into the season where we're all going to be talking about the debate? Do you see third-party candidates getting a place on that stage?
Not at the moment. I mean, the polling shows that Johnson, who's the closest, is hovering around, at best, 9%. And the Debates Commission announced which 5 polls they're going to use to consider in the debates. And Steve Shepard, our polling guru, has been keeping track of them. And unless things change quite significantly for them, or unless the Debates Commission decide to open up the criteria, which they have mentioned that they would potentially be open to doing, but that's if a Johnson gets up to like a 13.5 or even a 14%, then they might say, okay, well, you know, we'll give you the 1%, which would totally, I think, change the game if you've got a third person up there, which I don't know if Clinton is even preparing for that possibility.
Is it in her interest, Annie?
I don't think it is. I think that it would, first of all, I think one-on-one Trump-Clinton is a good comp for her. It's a setup that she has more experience with than him. He kind of got lost and could get lost for major segments of the primary debates with such a large field. It could allow for her to become a bystander while the others talk. And the other thing is, like, Trump has been talking about getting out of the debates. Like, I can't, like, say he gets out of it. Like, she doesn't want to just be up there with Johnson. Like, that's pointless for her. So I think that her best bet is a one-on-one matchup with him.
There's no way he doesn't do the September debate.
He has to do that one. Especially when you're losing, you have to. It's like the last chance.
Well, it's the last chance to make conspiracy theory the national narrative.
Right. He's going to hem and haw about the monitors, which are going to be announced any day now. I have reporting that, you know, I've been emailing with people and that it's coming very soon. I don't think that they're going to choose like a Megyn Kelly type, but I could see them choosing people that he's going to find some kind of offense with and will probably spin us all of us reporters for a loop for days on end about whether he's going to show up or not. And we're probably going to get shots of a empty podium on cable news until he actually walks up to it. But I just cannot imagine him not going to the first one. He will definitely go to it. And it's also like, the ratings from 2012 were at minimum 60 million people tuned in for these. Would Donald Trump really walk away from ratings that big?
Do you like covering this campaign, Amy?
I do.
Do you?
Is that weird?
No, it's not. What's been most surprising to you about covering the Clinton people?
They've been so, it really has been a disciplined campaign. And from what I heard about how Clinton World works and how dysfunctional 2008 was, it's not what I expected.
It's not at all leaky.
It's not leaky.
What's that credit to?
I mean, I've been trying to answer that question. Like, first of all, just in terms of how non-leaky it is, we all knew pretty much that it was going to be Kane for vice president. But literally no one could get a news alert out that said definitively Clinton picks Kane before she announced it. And that, like, that always leaks. It didn't even leak. Nothing leaks, really. I think, like, people credit Robbie and Podesta with running a tight ship. People credit the fact that, like, a lot of the leadership isn't long-term Clinton people. They brought in a lot of new people. I think the brain trust of people who actually are running the show is pretty small.
See, that's what's interesting. I think that at the start of the 16 cycle, everyone really thought there were going to be so many Clinton world people that the inner
on,
circle was going to be enormous.
The hangers-on, the outside kibitzers, the people who talk like on background reporters who pretend to know what's going on but don't. Like, though, it hasn't been like that. And I think it's because it's being run by non-Clinton, not her old guard is not there. But that surprised me. It's not what I expected of covering dysfunctional Clinton world and all their layers of people. It's also been just fun to watch, like, to cover the same candidate day in, day out from the beginning, like from the first Iowa roundtable where she was there with like 7 community college students pretending to take furious notes on her yellow pad and nodding a lot. And
was
then
she not taking notes?
She was.
Let's just inject this into the bloodstream here. If she's faking it, we want to know.
I don't mean faking it. I mean, like, whatever.
Was she doodling? Was she writing a letter to her grandchildren?
No,
what
was she taking
doing?
Taking notes.
Okay.
To like being at the convention and this huge, just watching it grow. Like, even that part they were very disciplined about. We all thought like these tiny events are so controlled. The whole thing has been very controlled. Her events are controlled. Her media appearances are controlled. The whole thing is controlled.
It's frustrating as an editor of you.
Yeah. It's frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. That's it for us. Goodbye, Scott.
I have a confession. Oh, I was doodling during this podcast. I would like to apologize.
There's no doodles on that paper.
Little arrows.
Oh, wait. There is. Yeah. You did doodle.
Farewell, everyone.
Hadas.
Bye.
Annie, thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to our producer this week, Matt Sobosinski, and to Dan Spinelli, one of Politico's fine summer interns who has helped pull these shows together behind the scenes. And thank you to our listeners. Talk to you next week.